your headlines for this hour. Palestinian resistance fighters have launched a large-scale operation against Israel, firing thousands of missiles into Israeli cities. The head of the political bureau of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, says the operation of Al-Aqsa flood against Israel will end with Palestinians' victory. And Iran says it supports the Palestinians in their fight against the Israeli occupation regime, with several other countries blaming Israel for the escalation. Thank you for joining us. In today's top story, Gaza-based Palestinian resistance fighters have launched a large-scale operation in the occupied territories. The Hamas resistance movement launched the Al-Aqsa flood operation early on Saturday, firing thousands of missiles towards Israeli cities, including Tel Aviv. The resistance fighters also broke through the barrier fence with the occupied territories and took control of a vast area near the besieged Gaza Strip. The unprecedented offensive left hundreds of Israelis killed and 1,500 others injured. The Israeli military has confirmed that a big number of Israeli settlers and military personnel were captured and taken into Gaza. Israel also launched strikes on different parts of Gaza, destroying residential buildings and leaving over 230 people dead and 1,700 others injured. Israel has cut off electricity supply to the blockaded strip, leaving hospitals and medical facilities in a tight spot amid a flow of casualties. Meanwhile, the Hamas resistance movement says Israeli soldiers captured by resistance forces are several times greater than what Netanyahu believes. The head of the political bureau of the Palestinian resistance movement, Hamas, says the operation of Al-Aqsa flood against Israel will end with Palestinians' victory. Ismail Haniyeh said the operation threw the regime off balance within minutes. He said this is in response to the Israeli raids on the Al-Aqsa Mosque and the blockade of Gaza. Haniyeh said Gaza-based resistance fighters won't stand idly by as Israel intensifies its attacks in the occupied territories. He stressed Al-Aqsa faces real danger as Israel is seeking to impose full sovereignty over the holy site. The top Hamas official called for general mobilization and urged resistance movements in the region to join the battle. Now we are joined by Mr. Christopher Halali, researcher and political analyst from Chicago. Mr. Halali, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me. Pleasure to be with you.
You're welcome, sir. Now, Mr. Halali, your initial thoughts on this surprise, which seems to be a well-organized, large-scale operation by the Gaza-based resistance fighters.
This is a world historic day. For the first time since 1948, Palestinian resistance has taken territory within the quote-unquote borders of 1948 Israel. This is enormous. This is huge. I'm having goosebumps thinking about it. We are celebrating. We are celebrating today because the Palestinians will take no more oppression, occupation, the brutality of an apartheid regime. The Zionist regime is collapsing. And what they have revealed today is the Zionist regime is a paper tiger. It has nothing that really supports it. It is a brutal, militarist, and racist regime that will collapse. Because the just struggle of the Palestinians will wipe it away. And that's the truth here. The Palestinians have already won, regardless of what happens on the ground in the coming days. The Palestinians showed the world what resistance looks like. And I believe that General Soleimani is looking down from above with a smile, looking and saying, this is what was necessary to complete liberation for the Palestinians.
Like you said, taking these territories, Mr. Halali, how significant is this?
This is very significant. I mean, we've never seen this happen. We've had multiple wars since the Nakba, since the catastrophe in 1948, the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from their land, from their homes, from their territory. This is the first time we've seen an actual encroachment back in to quote-unquote Israeli territory, which is just Palestinian territory. These are all settlers who have illegally occupied Palestinian homes and Palestinian land. And so the quote-unquote violation of this boundary is very, very symbolic for the fact that the Palestinians have every right under international law to return to their homes, to return to their land, and to return to their territory, which they still have the keys for those homes that they left, that they were forced from in 1948. So I think that this is very momentous, what has happened here. And regardless of what happens, this has shown the world that the Palestinians will continue to struggle till the last breathing Palestinian man, woman, and child to liberate their land for their self-determination.
Now, Mr. Al-Ali, some Western countries have condemned the attack, saying that or condemning Hamas for their operation. Now, what can you say in response to what they're saying? Because for many years, the Palestinians have been asking the Western countries to intervene and stop the Israeli atrocities. It's been for years now, for decades now. What do you have in response?
I have in response that it is complete hypocrisy that the United States and its allies, its Western allies and its regional lackeys, support Ukraine, giving billions of dollars of weapons to a fascist and neo-Nazi regime to liberate it from quote-unquote Russian imperialism. But here you have Palestinians who, under international law and the United Nations, have the right to struggle against a brutal occupation, against displacement, against colonization, against imperialism. And what do they have in response? They are labeled terrorists. They are not given weapons to support their struggle. They are condemned to an eternity in a jail, in an open-air prison, like in Gaza, or in perpetual military occupation and settlement expansion, like in the West Bank, until the land is ethnically cleansed of Palestinians. The bankruptcy of the West is on display today. Those who have crocodile tears for Israel and for the struggle of Israelis are the same ones who, according to international law, support the Palestinians, but they don't, because it shows their brutal racist positions, it shows their colonial positions and ideology, and it has shown them fully in front of the world who they really are. And they only care about themselves and their own power, and they don't care about what is really just. And that's the truth that is on display today.
There you have a researcher and political analyst, Mr. Christopher Al-Ali, all the way from Chicago. Thank you, sir. Now, we were earlier talking to our Gaza correspondent, Ashraf Shannon, when the Israeli regime targeted a residential building right next to him. The following video shows the moment the attack happened. Let's take a look and also listen to what Ashraf had to say.
Well, the Israeli regime said earlier that at least 35 Israelis are missing in the areas around the Gaza Strip. But Hamas, not official numbers here, the media releases, they're saying at least 50 Israelis were captured. But I've seen images and videos on social media. I can tell you the number is much higher. The building not far from my house, called the Palestine Tower, was hit right now. It's about 400 meters or 400 yards away from where we're standing. I believe this is not the last hit on that building. I believe there's a possibility of more airstrikes hitting that building. So this was very close to home, a close call, I think. And we hope no one was in that building.
Reactions pour in following Palestinians' anti-Israeli attack that took the regime by surprise on Saturday. Advisor to Iran's leader Rahim Safavi said Tehran is proud of the operation and supports Palestinians in their fight against the Israeli regime. Iran's foreign ministry also reacted, saying Hamas attacks show the Palestinians' confidence in the face of Israel. Nasser Kanani said the operation was a new chapter in armed resistance against the regime. Iraq said operations undertaken by Palestinians were a natural outcome of decades of oppression by, quote, the Zionist occupation. Qatar's foreign ministry issued a statement saying Israel is responsible for the ongoing escalation of violence. Kuwait made a similar statement, blaming Israel for the continued violence. Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Egypt, Bahrain and Russia have called for restraint. Earlier, we were joined by our Beirut correspondent, Mariam Saleh, who told us about the atmosphere in Lebanon regarding the Al-Aqsa flood operation.
The atmosphere in Lebanon, all of Lebanon, especially in the Palestinian refugee camps, is that of exalted joy. I don't think that we have felt this way since perhaps the 2000 liberation, the end of the 2006 war, although those were the fruit of years of sacrifice, of course, and killing. If I want to switch from perhaps for just a few seconds from being a journalist into being someone who is Lebanese from South Lebanon, we lived years of Israeli occupation, although it is not perhaps as massive as the suffering as the Palestinians have lived inside Palestine. Their entire homeland has been taken away from them. But here in Lebanon, we did witness that. So even the Lebanese here are saying that despite all our sacrifices and our resistance and the liberation that we did achieve after years of a war of attrition that were forced on the Israelis, still what is happening in Palestine right now is even more glorious than anything that we have lived here in Lebanon. And this is what you can hear from most of the Lebanese, especially those who are supporters of the resistance, which is a huge population here, of course, in Lebanon. The majority do support the liberation of Palestine. Everybody supports the liberation of Palestine, even if they do not perhaps have differences with the resistance when it comes politically.
We conducted interviews with several residents of the besieged Gaza Strip following the resistance forces' large-scale operation against Israel. They have told us how they feel about the attack of such a scale. Let's hear what they have to say.
All respect is for the Palestinian resistance soldiers for what they have done. We are proud of them and their doings. It is all for the sake of Al-Quds and our home country. This is the first time we have witnessed something like this in our generation since the beginning of the occupation.
We've been waiting for this day for so long. Alhamdulillah, finally, we defeated them inside their stations, settlements, and houses. We tolerate hunger, blockade, and electricity shortage, but we will never go easy when it comes to desecrating the Al-Aqsa Mosque and assaulting Palestinian women. Alhamdulillah, for this, what happened. May Allah bless the resistance with strength to beat the Israeli forces.
Saturday, October 7th, is a day of war against the Israeli occupation. The Al-Aqsa flood is the way to liberate Al-Quds. The civilians were able to breach inside the 1948 land this morning, and we saw no one of the Israelis there to stop us. We were walking as the landowners, and we will restore it very soon.
This is something honoring. The coming of our lives is yet shorter than what has passed. We have been waiting for a day like this our whole life. We were forced to leave our lands. We lost everything back in 1948. And this has to come to an end. What has been taken by force can only be recovered by force. Today, the whole country is celebrating this victory.
This morning, we witnessed a scene of its kind. The Palestinian resistance groups were dragging the Israeli soldiers out of the settlements, bringing them to Gaza. Allah will prevail.
We were earlier joined by a correspondent, Gisumi Shah Ahmadi, in downtown Tehran, where a huge crowd have gathered to support or in support of Palestinians in the fight against Israeli forces.
I'm located in Palestine Square, downtown Tehran. A full-fledged celebration is currently underway in support of Palestinians. A huge crowd has gathered in Palestine Square. They're chanting slogans, they're playing music, all of this in support of Palestinians. And of course, I also have to add that since this morning, when the news broke out, we've had Iranian officials reacting to the news about this surprise operation. They have been offering their support. Well, the first reaction we had was from an aide to the leader, Mr. Yahya Rahim Safavi, who expresses strong support for Palestinians and said that Iran will be standing right by Palestinians until the end, until the day they come out victorious from this battle. And then we had, of course, some parliamentarians in the Iranian parliament offering their support, gathering inside the parliament, chanting slogans to support the Palestinians. Obviously, we did have the foreign ministry, the spokesman for the foreign ministry, Mr. Kanaani, also offered his support.
Yemenis in the capital Sana'a attended a massive rally in support of the latest attacks against Israel by the Palestinian resistance fighters. Yusuf Mowry reports.
With our blood and with our lives, we support you, O Al-Aqsa. This was the chant that rang high in the streets of the Yemeni capital, where tens of thousands of Yemenis came out to express solidarity for the latest Palestinian offensive against Israel. Ansarullah officials at the rally congratulated what they called an unprecedented Palestinian attack that exposed just how weak the Israeli regime is. Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, a prominent Ansarullah official, believes power is the only initiative Israel will respect.
Following the surprise offensive against Israel, senior Hamas military commander has called on all Islamic resistance movements in the region, including Lebanon's Hezbollah and Yemen's Ansarullah movement, to unite efforts to liberate Palestine today, not tomorrow. Yusuf Mowry, Sana'a.
Well, that's it for this hour's bulletin. Thank you for being with us. Take care and bye-bye.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A European official has said the European Union countries no longer can give weapons to Ukraine from their own stockpiles without endangering their own security. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Politico has reported, citing a European official, EU countries have given Ukraine all the arms they can without compromising their own defense. Kiev is facing cuts to both arms supplies and cash injections as cracks appear in Western support. The European source said, as quoted recently, "We cannot keep on giving from our own stockpiles." There may still be robust political support, but we've given everything that will not endanger our own security. The comment was made to Politico as part of its coverage of the recent International Industries Defense Forum in Kiev, during which the host went on a charm offensive directed at weapons makers, as explained in the report. In a separate story recently, Politico said that support for funding the Ukrainian government was showing more cracks than ever. According to RT, the failure of the U.S. Congress recently to allocate aid money in its stopgap budget, the election victory of former Slovak Prime Minister Robert Fico, who vowed to stop assistance to Ukraine on the campaign trail, and Kiev's ongoing diplomatic row with Poland all sent a chilling message. The Ukrainian government expects to receive at least $42.8 billion from international donors next year, as outlined in its projected budget. An expected fight over the EU's joint budget means that no one dares to predict anything at this point, a diplomatic source told Politico. Another diplomat said the big elephant in the room in Europe is the concern that Washington could abandon Ukraine. The event in Kiev was part of its effort to ramp up domestic military production. Germany's Rheinmetall and the UK-based BAE have made some commitments to open production facilities in Ukraine. Kiev's goal is to become an Israel in Europe, with help from other countries. Daniel Vajic, a Washington-based advocate for Ukraine, has told Politico. President Volodymyr Zelensky floated the idea of paying for the proposed build-up with confiscated Russian assets when he spoke at the forum. Prime Minister Denis Shmyhal indicated that the proposed plans would not be safe. He said 37 of Ukraine's own facilities have been damaged by Russia. Russian officials have stressed that foreign-funded arms manufacturing sites in Ukraine would be treated as legitimate military targets. Denis Pushilin, the head of the Donetsk People's Republic, reiterated the policy during an interview recently. Meanwhile, RT reported the Pentagon has warned Congress that it does not have adequate funds to replace weapons sent to Ukraine, prompting concerns about Washington's ability to adequately resupply its own troops. Associated Press reported recently. In a letter sent to congressional leaders and obtained by Associated Press, the Pentagon called on lawmakers to replenish funding for Ukraine. The request comes days after a last-minute budget deal was struck to prevent a disruptive shutdown of the federal government, but did not contain additional funding for Kiev requested by the White House. Pentagon Comptroller Michael McCord wrote in the letter, "We have already been forced to slow down the replenishment of our own forces to hedge against an uncertain funding future. Failure to replenish our military services on a timely basis could harm our military's readiness." McCord added that if funding requests aren't met, the Pentagon might be restricted from supplying Ukraine with weapons it views as critical and urgent now as Russia prepares to conduct a winter operation. McCord told House and Senate leaders there is presently $1.6 billion remaining from a $25.9 billion funding previously approved by Congress to replace U.S. military resources sent to Ukraine. Separately, the U.S. has approximately $5.4 billion remaining to provide equipment to Kiev from its own existing stockpiles. The U.S. regime would have already run out of that funding by now had the Pentagon not realized this year that it had overhauled some equipment sent to Ukraine, freeing up around $6.2 billion, some of which has since been sent to Ukraine in the form of weapons and other aid. U.S. President Joe Biden said recently, "We cannot under any circumstances allow America's support for Ukraine to be interrupted. We have time, not much time, and there is an overwhelming sense of urgency." Democratic efforts to continue funding the Ukrainian military have been met with significant resistance from some Republican hardliners, suggesting a growing shift towards a more isolationist position among some GOP members. House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, whose budget legislation was signed by Biden to prevent the government shutdown, said on CBS News recently that while he supports Kiev in its fight against Moscow, he believes issues closer to home, such as the security of the United States' southern border, are more pressing concerns.
Food for thought.
Hello everyone, let us listen to this thought-provoking saying from Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, the vicegerent of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Do not make a sinner despair. Many of the sinful enjoy a happy end on repentance, while many of the seemingly devout rupture their deeds and deserve hell. Allah may protect us from hell.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, giving away for the sake of Allah to the poor in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is such an honor to be here at your presence, dear friends. We're talking about how we should give away for the sake of Allah a part of our wealth to the poor, as this is a part of our Islamic lifestyle. Now, this is something that's really important, and unfortunately, we have a tendency to forget. It seems like when we were financially less well off, we really felt the pain of the people who are poor and who are disenfranchised. or who don't have such a strong financial status. But it seems like once we start to acquire wealth and we start to become a little bit rich and wealthy, we have a tendency to very easily forget all of those people that are poor and are disenfranchised and, you know, have a lower social and financial standing than we do. Islam, right from the inception and as a part of this Islamic lifestyle, the Almighty Allah, via the Messenger of Allah, sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi, as well as the divinely appointed Imams, alayhimus salam, they have taught us that it is necessary to help the poor. It is necessary for us to raise up the financial standing of the poor. And of course, charity and altruism and almsgiving are all very integral parts of Islam. It is us who unfortunately tend to forget that a part of our Islamic lifestyle should be helping the poor and the needy. Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So, dear friends, we are talking about how we should spend for the sake of Allah by giving to the poor in our Islamic lifestyle. So, as we had said, helping the poor is something which is incredibly important. It is something which is highly emphasized and encouraged in our Islamic lifestyle. You know, sometimes we think that we have to be incredibly rich to give money on the path and for the sake of Allah to the poor. Well, sometimes we think that I don't have enough, so what's the point of giving anything? Now, these both situations are not correct. If we have a lot of wealth, you know, whatever amount of wealth that is, we should give on the path of Allah and we should give for the sake of Allah. And on the other hand, if we feel like we don't have that much, we don't need to give that much either. It is kind of a balance with ourselves. You know, of course, in our Islamic lifestyle, it is also, you know, we have been warned to not give in charity to such an extent that we ourselves fall into charity and we fall into the need of you know, having to need a helping hand or a handout. No, we should give charity in a balanced manner, but the important thing is to constantly give charity and to help the needy, to help the poor, and to not forget those individuals who need our helping hand in our Islamic lifestyle.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
This is the story of poison and decline, of criminal affairs and corrupted politicians. This is the story of a raped land, a story of death, black smoke and stinging throats. It's the story of brave mothers and of a frontier priest, the story of men that never surrender, even when everyone else thinks they're crazy, and of a journalist that names names. This is the story of doctors pleading with the government and of a government that keeps the evidence of a disaster hidden. In southern Italy, between the provinces of Naples and Caserta, the environmental damage has occurred in the form of waste. Not simple waste, but special industrial waste. This is a complex story which links organized crime, industries, and politics. The story begins with toxic waste left in the countryside and burned day and night. That place is called the Land of Fires. Campania is a grazing land, a paradise for agriculture. Ancient Romans called it Campania Felix, the happy land, because in a few square kilometers, this region combined prosperity and a mild climate, sea and volcanic soils. It was one of the world's most beautiful and fertile places. Now, it's only a poisoned, sick land which remains. This is the story of the biggest mass poisoning ever known in the history of the Western world. Organized crime plays a huge role in this story. The Camorra, one of the oldest and biggest criminal groups of Italy, runs and regulates illegal waste disposal, controls the territory and organizes burnings. These burnings, however, are just the visible aspect. The real issue is the burial of dangerous materials. Huge holes in the ground are filled with industrial waste of every kind. This has happened in Campania for more than 20 years. 400,000 trucks have crossed Italy from north to south, carrying more than 10 million tons of toxic waste. Everything began in the 1980s. The story of Campania is first of all a story of betrayal. Streets are covered in rubbish, mountains of waste invade the cities. However, as it happens for toxic burnings, this is just the more visible problem, and also a way to distract attention from what has actually happened. While everyone talks about the emergency regarding urban waste, hundreds of trucks pour tons of toxic industrial waste in the countryside, the birth of eco-mafia. The principal players in this are politicians, the Camorra, and the barons of heavy industry. More than 6,000 burnings in only 6 months. 110 dump sites financed with 148 million euros. 70 unauthorized dumpings. More than 2,558 potentially polluted sites. Campania is a territory under attack. The Italian state has issued, embarrassingly late, a mapping of vulnerable territories. The percentage of dangerous sites is said to be around 2%, but this figure is laughable. The true story is this. In Campania, for more than 25 years, soil, air, and water have been absorbing carcinogenic substances, dioxin, heavy metals, benzene, mercury, arsenic, a continuous attack, a real biocide in broad daylight. The first warning signs of this environmental catastrophe with public participation was evident in the fruits of the land, then in turn with the animals. The environmental and landscape capital that is typical of the Campania region is slowly disappearing. Apart from nature itself, by now devastated, it is agriculture and breeding that bear the brunt of it. An immense damage on a biological level. But this is also an economic disaster, damaging the image of breeders and rural enterprises. Within the story of Campania, there is also the story of a mystery, a secret that has been hidden for years, and that for years was buried in the drawers and consciences of the Italian Parliament. Carmine Schiavone, a supergrass from the Casa Lazy Camorra clan, told the Parliamentary Committee of Inquiry on Waste everything about what was happening in Campania. He named names and places. He said, in 20 years, everyone there will be dead. This was 1997. His words were covered under the Official Secrets Act and have been kept hidden until today. 20 years ago, the Italian government already knew everything. In order to understand what is happening in the land of fires, we have to count. Count the people who died from cancer. Count the decimated families. This is the story of an Italian epidemic, a shocking plague clearly shown by medical records. In Campania, the risk of lung cancer is 30% higher than the national average, and the average mortality risk is 9% higher for men and 12% higher for women. Congenital abnormalities have increased by 83%. But the real massacre concerns children. They die at 2, 6, 12 years old, and in Naples, pediatric cancer institute beds are never empty. What happens when everything around you is nothing but destroyed land, poisoned animals, countless deaths? What happens if a criminal, cowardly past gives birth to a present dominated by fear and doubts? Campania is a broken place. It has at the same time been betrayed by the state, an atrocious experiment carried out by the Camorra and irreparably damaged. It is an unknown future. But what happens if an entire population rises up to say no more? On November the 16th, 2013, Naples was invaded by an enormous parade crossing the city in the rain. For the first time after 20 years of lies and poison, the citizens of the Land of Fires have come together to say stop to the biocide. Everyone was there, associations, committees, but also mothers, artists, doctors, researchers, and students. Over 120,000 people. This is also the story of a revolution, a flooding river that has burst its banks and is asking for truth and justice.
Life is full of choices. Choose the best option. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A new report finds that five major global insurers are still backing U.S. coal mines, even when they have promised not to. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Greece wrote, "The insurance industry is in a state of flux because of climate change. This year has seen a record-breaking number of costly disasters in the United States, and insurance companies are on the hook for much of that property damage. But even as insurers pull out of disaster-prone areas, deeming them too risky to insure, they are continuing to cover one of the most polluting industries, coal." A new report from Public Citizen, a nonprofit advocacy organization, and Insure Our Future, a global coalition aimed at holding the insurance industry accountable for its role in climate change, details the extent to which global insurers are propping up U.S. coal mining companies. In 2022, five insurers, AIG, Liberty Mutual, Lloyd's of London, Swiss Re, and Zurich, provided policies covering 41% of U.S. coal production, even though most of these insurers have made climate commitments. These companies' policies enable coal mines to continue operating despite their destructive impact on the climate. The report found that many of the companies still insuring coal mines have publicly promised to stop underwriting coal projects or made net zero pledges in response to pressure from investors and activists. The report details how companies use loopholes like covering mining subsidiaries instead of parent companies, in addition to blatantly breaking their own rules to continue to ensure coal production. Mary Sweeters, a co-author of the report and an organizer with Insure Our Future, said the findings show that commitments alone are not enough to prevent warming. Sweeters told Greece, "Climate commitments are only as strong as the details in their policies. This shows that these policies are weak and are not aligned with the 1.5 degree Celsius pathway." A recent report from the International Energy Agency found that limiting warming to 1.5 degrees Celsius, which would prevent the worst impacts of climate change, is still possible if countries accelerate their deployment of renewables. Carly Fabian, an insurance policy advocate at Public Citizen, who contributed research to the coal report, pointed out that the insurance industry plays a crucial role in determining the fate of fossil fuel projects. Fossil fuel projects can't operate without insurance because insurance is typically needed to secure financing, she explained, adding, "Insurance companies are sort of gatekeepers. They provide a lifeline to the fuel industry. And if they stop providing coverage, it becomes that much harder for coal mines to continue operating." In some ways, insurance companies' climate commitments are working. Even as they continue to insure mines, insurers' restrictions on underwriting coal power generation has generally rendered new coal plants almost uninsurable at this point. Meanwhile, many of the same insurers still covering coal mines have stopped issuing policies to homeowners who are at risk of fires, hurricanes, and other disasters exacerbated by coal emissions. For instance, AIG, which underwrites 28% of U.S. coal production, stopped insuring homeowners in California last year. According to Fabian, this means that insurers are contributing to climate change while shifting the consequences onto individuals. She said, The insurance industry has so far been saying, we are gonna offload these costs and risks into the public, consumers and taxpayers. They're gonna pay through higher insurance premiums, deductibles, reduce coverage, and we're gonna walk away from the homeowners. The report calls on insurance companies to stop underwriting coal mining and to strengthen their climate commitments. Sweeters also noted, increased regulation could help by requiring the insurance industry to disclose ties to the fossil fuel industry. But since insurance is regulated on the state level, it would have to happen in a piecemeal fashion. Sweeter said, regulators need to step up and recognize the role that insurance companies are playing in continuing to enable the expansion of fossil fuels and driving climate change. According to Guardian, Lloyd's of London and other big European insurers are underwriting almost a third of US coal production despite their net zero pledges, according to research, with the Lloyd's insurance market emerging as the second biggest player. A report from the Insure Our Future campaign group found that Lloyd's, Zurich and Swiss Re are among the top 10 insurers of the 25 biggest US coal mines, which produced more than 60% of the country's output last year. They underwrite 13 mines, producing 30.7% of U.S. coal. Coal is the largest contributor of carbon dioxide emissions, and the U.S. is the fourth largest producer of coal worldwide. Last year, mining 595 million short tons, a measure commonly used in the U.S. equal to 2,000 pounds. Even though 45 big global insurers have adopted policies limiting coal underwriting in recent years, the report found that some are exploiting loopholes or violating their own policies to continue insuring coal mines. Guardian continued, AIG is the biggest underwriter of U.S. coal, insuring seven mines producing 167 M short tons in 2022, 28.1% of national output. Lloyd's of London comes second, with Lloyd's insurers underwriting 10 mines producing 135 M short tons, 22.8% of output. Most of the insurance certificates analyzed by the campaign group involving Lloyd's say, underwriters at Lloyd's of London or certain underwriters at Lloyd's without naming the firms. As the world's biggest insurance market, Lloyd's has committed to leading the market to a net zero underwriting position, yet it does not mandate or restrict the underwriting policies of its 85 market members. As a member of the Net Zero Insurance Alliance, part of the Glasgow Financial Alliance for Net Zero, set up by the UN Climate Envoy Mark Carney, Lloyd's has pledged to become net zero as a corporation by 2025, while the investments from its £3 billion central fund will be net zero by 2050. The market started divesting from coal in 2018, but has been slower than other insurers. Lindsay Keenan, the European coordinator of the insurance Our Future, said, Lloyd's is exposed yet again as a leading insurer of the fossil fuels that are causing the climate crisis. He added, other Lloyd's members, managers, staff and investors need to step up alongside civil society and help to persuade their peers to firmly commit to stop insuring all coal mining in OECD countries by 2030 and to reduce their coverage of coal by 50% by 2025 in line with the action taken by other leading insurers as directed by climate science. water resources won't last long. A relatively hot day in the fall of 2017. That day, in the small town of Zegora in southern Morocco, could have ended in peace quietly like any other day. But that day wasn't like the other days in the desert in Morocco. People in the desert region had gathered from different areas for something important in Zegora. At a first glance, you'd think that they were protesting against planting watermelon in that region and exporting it to other countries. I mean, it was just a small protest for better working and living conditions. But after a short while, 23 of the protesters who were there in small numbers were arrested in a police raid, and the others quickly scattered. Apparently, the protests were over, but the livelihood of the people in that region was dependent on buying bottles of water, because the water in the wells had dried up, so they couldn't drink water and do agriculture. Exporting watermelon to Europe would further reduce the level of underground water resources in that region, so they couldn't stand to watch it. In no time, the protests became more complicated. Morocco is about 710,000 square kilometers located in the Western Sahara in North Africa. Rabat is the capital city and Casablanca is the largest city. Since its establishment in 780 BC, Morocco has seen many monarchs and rulers, from the Portuguese occupation of a swath of the land in the 15th century to resistance against the Ottoman occupation and becoming the only country in North Africa that refused to be under the domination of the Ottoman Empire. From 1980 to mid-2010, Morocco used over 70% of non-renewable water resources for agriculture. The statistics showed that it will fall below the abject drought line until the mid-2020s. But why would officials opt for products that require a lot of water while they're aware that the country is located in a desert and providing water has always been a major challenge? But the condition to protect the stability was to continue extracting water in large volumes and keep parching the land. Insisting on keeping the status quo would shroud the future of the country and foreign investment in ambiguity. On the one hand, the country's stability was at risk, and on the other hand, the government would blame the drought for everything. It wouldn't admit that its decisions were influenced by the structure and plans inherited from the colonial era. Syria's underground water resources were drained during those years. Although Syria has gone through different spells of drought throughout history, rising temperatures of the earth has unprecedentedly escalated the impacts of the drought in recent years. About 70% of the cattle in the region have perished. In 2010, wheat production in Syria was reduced by 18% and 3 million